Welcome to IPEC Presents. Our podcast features research from the Institute for Policy, Ethics, and Culture at Michigan Tech, a public research university in Houghton, Michigan. I'm your host, Kendall Bella Pavlovich, and each episode of IPEC Presents is dedicated to discussing the research our institute conducts in service of policy implication, ethical considerations, and cultural significance of the massive changes and disruptive forces underway in our world. Our guest today is Dr. Jason Archer, an assistant professor of communication and media technologies here at Michigan Tech. Jason serves on the executive committee of IPEC and leads our human-machine culture research area. This research area focuses on the developing dynamics between humans and machines, the ways humans and communicative machines sense and make sense of the world together, and the cultural impacts of those formations. The research group encourages contrarian examinations and creative explorations that mirror the dynamism of emerging cultural configurations. Always in flux, always in flow. Prior to joining Michigan Tech in 2022, Jason was a visiting professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago within the Department of Communication. He holds a PhD in communication from the same university, and his research interests include haptic media studies, sensory media studies, human-machine communication, and science and technology studies. Jason's recent chapter, Haptics, Human Augmentics, and Human-Machine Communication, was published in the SAGE Handbook of Human Communication, which will be linked in this episode's description. Jason is an active researcher whose work is shaping the way we think about human and machine connection, especially in the field of haptics. So Jason, you've been a faculty member at Michigan Tech for under a year. What's been your first impression of being here?
So I've had a lot of impressions coming from the University of Illinois at Chicago up to here. First and foremost, when I decided to take the position, the job up here and applied to it, I was excited by the idea that Michigan Tech was a technical university because although my research is very social science and humanities oriented, I'm very interested in technology and culture and their intersections.
Yeah.
So being able to be at a research institution where I can engage with people who are designing and implementing and standardizing these kinds of technologies is really an exciting place to be in terms of maybe being able to help shape and understand the conversations that are happening in those spaces from a more critical orientation.
Absolutely.
And so that's part of what has led me to wanting to form the Human Machine Culture Research Group. And I know we'll get more into that in a minute. But is the possibility of trying to work on developing some of those connections.
Okay.
And just in some other terms of how it's been in the first year, I mean, it's been a very welcoming community. I've found people to be very warm. Colleagues have been very helpful. And the scholarly community here has been very engaging.
Yeah.
I've had no lack of opportunities in my first year. Maybe sometimes it feels like too many opportunities. It's hard to turn down good ones. And also, I've been really impressed with the students here. They've been largely engaged in the classes that I've taught. I've taught communication and culture in my first year, and also interpersonal communication and technology.
Okay.
And students really seem to enjoy those classes. So
yeah, our students here are really like hands-on in terms of they want activities to do. They want to be in the weeds, like working with, you know, the different technologies or whatever, like concepts that they're working on in class, right? Like I find that even in the classes that I teach, which are composition, technical and professional communication, and public speaking and multimedia, like they really just want to be in the class and outside doing different things instead of just like being taught and learned at.
Yeah, for sure. So, and I'm going to be teaching a human-machine communication course
really?
For the first time this fall. So that's going to be a new course. I'm in the process of finishing developing it right now for the end of the summer. And I'm really excited about that course because I am trying to design it in a way that it can link into the human-machine culture research group so that if there are students in the class that might see some crossover, I might be able to have some undergraduate researchers doing some aligned research with the research group as well.
So. Well, that sounds amazing that you're able to tie in the like As you said, the various opportunities that are presented to you, because I really do think I agree with you in terms of like this campus presents a lot of opportunities. We have so much research going on. But sometimes for undergraduates, it can seem sort of top level and it's all about the faculty or the enterprise teams or the capstone projects or, you know, really getting into it in your third and fourth years. But to have that door open for students, especially when you're thinking about being in a humanities department at a STEM university, a lot of those research activities are focused more on the STEM and the social sciences and the forestry and the going out and the doing of things.
Right.
It's a little bit harder for us when the doing of things is related to computers or, you know, being on the computer or doing this kind of research. So I think that's really wonderful that you're able to open up those opportunities for undergraduate students to do different kinds of things.
I hope, anyway.
Yeah, so as we're talking about that, I think that's a great lead-in for thinking about, you're on the executive committee of IPEC. How did you get there, and how did you come to lead the research area human-machine culture?
Sure, so when I first came, even before I accepted the position here, I learned a lot about the institutes that were taking root here at Michigan Tech. I know that they're relatively recent innovations here at the university. And so I had become interested in IPEC because it aligned with a lot of the things that I was interested in, especially because a lot of my research and my background is coming from more of a media and cultural studies orientation.
Okay.
And so IPEC seemed like an institute that was maybe most closely aligned with the kinds of issues and ideas that I would be interested in.
Yeah.
Along with like the Institute of Cultural and Computing and
Cyber systems.
Right.
Yeah.
Cyber systems. Yeah. We can double check that. But so I am involved with that group as well. And also with HRI, the Health Research Institute, which I haven't formally affiliated with, but I will probably at some point, especially with the HSTEM, being built onto campus.
Yeah.
But so anyway, that's taking a long route here. But I got involved also because of Dr. Jennifer Slack, who was the former director.
Yes.
We had talked about it quite a bit. She invited me to interview Matt Bean last year for the Work in Transition speaker series.
Okay.
And then once Stefka, Dr. Ristrova had taken over as director, she also knew that I was very interested in IPEC and also the potential for this affiliated PhD program and responsible, socially responsible technology, I think, is where we're kind of talking about it right now.
Yeah.
And so she invited me to put for a proposal for a research group, and I did. Okay. And so that's how it came to be. Or that's how I came to be on the executive committee.
Yeah.
I guess also just accepting to do it. It is, at the end of the day, a service, but it's a service I really am excited about.
I didn't know that you were involved also in two other institutes, one formally, as you said, and then one informally at the moment. I think it's really wonderful, especially for, and I'm just thinking in terms of how this might benefit IPEC, forming those research communities across campus. It's really interesting because if you don't know Michigan Tech, we have our various colleges and departments, and they're kind of spread out on campus in such a way that it becomes a nucleus of research for each of those colleges and or departments. Like having the crossover between the humanities department here at Michigan Tech and various other colleges and departments is a little bit different than, say, just the general STEM community that we have. And so I think it's really wonderful that we're starting to, and already have, and I don't want to take away from the work that other people have done as well, but to really continue to build those bridges across campus and have different conversations. I've noticed in a lot of the work that I've done that's interdisciplinary that you get to talking from people from different departments. So like, for example, I work closely with a lot of people in the forestry department. We're having the same conversations, but we're not having those conversations together. And so the discovery of like, oh, we're interested in the same things, we can do work together, I think that's really cool.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with you. And I think that that's one of the things that the institutes should be able to accommodate to some degree. So hopefully that's happening more and more as we build those collaborations across institutes. But I do think that IPEC has a very specific and unique standing amongst the institutes, especially in providing more, I would say, critical core cultural orientations. And again, we're thinking about questions about policy and ethics along the lines and not just making things.
Yes.
And again, we're going to talk about it in a minute, but that's partly where I wanted to articulate a research group around human-machine culture that is something distinct and different from, say, human-computer interaction or things that are happening with human factors, which are really important. But there is a distinction to be made, and there is a different kind of research questions that we can be asking about the same kinds of technologies and the same kinds of materials that lead to different kinds of insights that can then, again, we can work across the disciplines to try to meet some of these bigger challenges that you can't meet just in one space.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to kind of end that thought and turning it back to Dr. Jennifer Slack, who is just an incredible scholar, and she's provided so much to our Michigan tech community. Being an undergraduate here myself, I had taken some of her courses, and one that I took was culture and technology. And what happens is, instead of thinking about culture and technology, which is the title of that same book that she wrote with a co-author, we're thinking about technological culture. And putting it in those terms, especially for STEM students, our engineers, and people who are thinking about technology, to really bring those things together and see how the human dimension is involved with that, I think is sometimes a really big light bulb that turns on for students, but also for people who are just interested, right, in the research.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and it's funny that you bring that up, because so Jennifer Slack, Dr. Slack, the way that she's positioning that relationship is through this term called technoculture, which is this that she wrote a book on it, a very useful resource for understanding that relationship.
Yeah,
it isn't the first who's done research in this area. It's a very broad research area, and I would say human machine culture and communication actually. They largely are similar in some ways to technoculture. And I've debated a little bit about whether or not this terminology makes a lot of sense, I'll get to why a little bit in a minute, but what the distinctions are between technoculture and human machine culture, for instance. And some of this might be a little bit of marketing and reframing, but there is more to it than that.
Right.
And so we'll get to that.
Yeah. So one thing that we tend to think about, I think, in this department and in the many classes and conversations that I've had with folks is words matter. And the way that you play with words also matters. So after we come back from our break, we are going to talk about what human machine culture means. All right. And we're back from our break. So, Jason, I want to ask you, what does human-machine culture mean to you? And what are the implications of this exciting area of research?
So that's a really great question. It's a really hard question to answer, to be honest. But I've been thinking about it a lot. I was thinking about it a lot in trying to come up with a name for the research group, because I've constructed this along the lines of and being related to human-machine communication, which is an area of research that has been has been around for quite a while in different iterations, but has only in the last 5 or 6 years been more formalized as a subdiscipline, or is becoming formalized as a subdiscipline within the field of communication and media studies. And so there was a book that was just published in July called The Sage Handbook of Human-Machine Communication. The editors are Andrea Guzman, Rhonda McEwen, and Steve Jones, and I have a chapter in there. And that, it really does a great job. It's 66 chapters or something.
Oh my God.
A giant handbook. Fairly small chapters, though, like 7-8-page chapters, like 5,000-6,000 word articles or chapters. And it covers the entire breadth, for the most part, of what's happening in this area so far. And so if you get in there, you really start to see it's really this, for being such a young, formalized area, it's really covering a lot of ground very quickly.
Yeah.
And it developed in response to other areas like human-robot interaction, human-computer interaction, AI interaction.
Can I stop you right there?
Sure.
Because so what's really interesting about this is that you're saying human-AI, human robot, and then you have human machine, human technology. What is the difference between AI, technology, and then machine, right? So like, what is the really special importance of using the word machine versus other terminology?
That's a great question. I'm going to do two answers because I was going to finish that thought, because there's two words that you actually need to be focusing on: machine, but also communication.
Right.
Why communication, not interaction?
Yeah.
Right? Because those are the pivot points for this.
Okay.
So machine instead of robot, AI, technology. The reason that it's oriented around machine is that it very specifically articulates a certain, it both encapsulates and broadens what we consider to be communicative agents,
okay,
or things to have agency potentially,
right,
or things that we anthropomorphize. These are two concepts that often get brought into human machine communication.
Yeah.
And so, you know, definitely human machine communication involves robots. Mm-hmm. It involves AI. Mm-hmm. It involves potentially wearables. So it's about broadening a little bit what we conceptualize as things that we interact with.
Okay.
But then also pivoting away from this notion of interaction to communication is one that says it's not just about this kind of input-output orientation, that interaction framework really comes maybe more from engineering and the technical side of research and psychology as well. This is where human factors and such.
So kind of like a linear model of communication.
A little bit more of a linear transmission model, right, of communication. And so, then the pivot point for human-machine communication is one more towards ritual forms of communication, or understanding that, like, there's these relational developments that are happening between you and a machine that maybe have nothing to do with the interface and the way that it's articulated and the way that it's designed and developed, but that you maybe have some feelings about it, or it changes the way that you think about yourself, right?
Okay.
Like, I was thinking about, I'll get back to that in a second, actually. So those are a couple of the breaking points that I see.
Okay.
But it's a really good question, because sometimes I don't know whether that machine is a little too large.
Yeah.
But I also know the people who have been really instrumental in developing this subfield. And a lot of the discourse that's happening right now is really pushing against trying to set any firm boundaries of what this can or should be.
Okay.
And part of that is, I think, rooted in, is coming from a place that's maybe more influenced by cultural studies and saying, like, we want to be very careful about boundary setting, because whenever we do that, we become exclusive.
Exclusionary.
Right, exclusionary, right? When we define things, when we start to measure things in very specific ways, we start to create blind spots. And so at least at this point, it's really trying to take this broad-based approach.
Okay.
And then to just connect this back to the human-machine culture and what I mean by that, and why I decided to do a research group with culture instead of communication. You know, again, this is where everything is happening. So why am I doing this culture? One is because I think that as a subdiscipline, human-machine communication is a little bit too oriented right now towards the social sciences and towards kind of quantitative investigations of these relationships. And a lot of it's also looking at, like, interpersonal forms of human-machine communication relationships, which is super important. But I think that we do a disservice when we only stick at that level, and that we can broaden it out a little bit more. And there is also critical cultural work going on in this area.
Yeah.
But to try to articulate this in a little more, like, to try to give it some definition for the purposes of the research group and also my thinking and other people's thinking about this.
Right.
I kind of see there's, like, at least three different ways that I think about human-machine culture when I'm thinking about this formulation.
Okay.
In the first instance, I'm thinking about this in terms of culture that represents human-machine connections or relations or configurations, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, the movies that we watch that have humans and machines in them, and the relationships that they develop, right?
Okay.
And the values that are embedded and expressed through those media.
Okay.
Because that level of cultural creation provides some kinds of discourses to how then we interact with or think about those technologies when we encounter them in real space, right? And so, like, you often have this mismatch between what's represented as a human-machine future, right? Or present even, and then what a robot is really like, or what an AI agent is really like when you interact with them. And then, so, like, how is that setting some kind of cultural boundaries? What are the kinds of questions that we could be asking about those representations, and then how they infuse and inflect our understanding and our relation with those objects in other spaces.
Okay.
So that's one level.
Okay.
And then another level that I think about this in terms of is how culture is created between humans and machines. And I should step back very quickly, because I had mentioned before that there was this similarity for me between technoculture and human-machine culture.
Yeah.
And the distinction I want to make here is that what I do want to focus on is trying to think about the machines as communicative machines.
Okay.
So machines that in some way have some communicative potential. Like, there are easy examples of this, things like generative AI, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is not reading some pre-script, but that has been programmed to you know, assemble different kinds of data, or like based on his training data, to come up with new and novel expressions itself. And so it becomes a producer of language.
Right.
Right. Even though the human's infused in that, as a technoculture approach would suggest, it also is articulating something that is beyond just, you know, a pre-made script or something, right? And that we also perceive as being another kind of entity and not just a technology, not just an instrument.
Right.
Right? It becomes more of a thing that we see in relational ways.
Yeah, I notice even when I'm using like ChatGPT, for example, to ask it to give me some book ideas because I love writing. I say please and thank you, and I am really polite and courteous because even though this is an AI piece of technology, I just feel like there is like this aura involved in the relationship of communicating with this machine, this other thing, and I try to be really respectful about that. I know there's many different ways to interact, but I don't know. I just feel like I'm speaking not to another human, but to another like entity or thing that deserves my respect as well.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really good point. There's actually another colleague of ours in the department, Maria Bergstrom, just told me the story the other day about being at a design workshop. And one of the things that she had to do was do a reflection assignment with an AI bot.
Okay.
And she said that within the interface, there was just one button that said you could end the session. But as it was asking questions, after like three or four questions, she didn't feel like she wanted to keep responding, but she didn't feel like she could push the end button.
Okay.
So she kept responding, and she, you know, she suggested it was, you know, part of kind of this Midwest culture.
Right.
It's kind of almost, you know, like you have to be kind, you have to be nice, you have to be polite, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And she thought it was strange, but she couldn't kind of get over that. And I think that's really emblematic of this human-machine culture, right? And the way that we can justify all that we want, this is just a technology, it's just an instrument, but we are responding to it as, like you said, not a thing.
Right.
It's something else.
Yeah.
Right. And David, there's a researcher, a philosopher and ethicist at the Northern Illinois University named David Gunkel, who spent the last 10 years or so trying to think through this question of communicating with machines and how they represent something that is more than an object, more than a thing, more than a human.
Right.
It's an other kind of entity. And we need different kind of language to understand that because of its otherness, then we have to think about law a little differently. We have to think politics a little differently. We have to think about our relationships a little differently. And so that is getting at kind of what I mean by what I want to think about when I think about human-machine culture at another level, and another way of thinking about it. And, you know, you can think of lots of other kinds of these dichotomies in terms of like all of these AI, generative AIs, and the way that they're influencing the art world, for instance, right? Like last year was all about, we had the art in silico with IPEC, right?
Yeah.
And AI, generative AI with humans are winning art competitions, right? And then it's creating these discourses where we have to grapple with, well, what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable? And is it okay that we're doing this with a machine? Mm-hmm. And is this somehow a different kind of cultural representation than just a human? And what does that mean for creativity and the way that we see creativity, right? And the way that how do we engender our development and what that means in terms of our relationship with these communicative machines? And in some ways, that's a new conversation. In some ways, it's not. It's an old conversation. It's one that's, we have... This is the technoculture part of it where, you know, since the development of writing, when you want to go to the long way back, you know, there has been this grappling of what it means to be human in relation to technology and how technology maybe influences our humanity or our humanness, right?
Yeah.
And so that's part of what we want to get at here. But again, I think the break here is really that I want to be focusing on communicative machines, things that we either really think about as communicative, because you can make very broad arguments, and I often find myself doing so, that, you know, I think of lots of inanimate things that aren't traditionally communicative, and that they don't maybe have a voice, or that they're not generating text, as things that can be communicative because we perceive them as being that way, or we respond to them, you know, like giving a car a name, for instance, or, you know, in the office, like breaking your printer, you know, like taking all of your anger out on your printer because it's somehow wronged you, right?
Is there a story behind that, or is that just an example?
It's just an example. Although, like Clifford and Nass, for instance, in early formulations that kind of serve as some predecessor to human-machine communication, or some of what's developed, they develop a model called CASA, which is Computers as Social Actors, which really started to articulate for the first time, at least in psychological circles, how people were perceiving computers as actors with agency and not just instruments.
To extend that back further, one thing that I think is really interesting is, A, this idea that we have of, like, computers as sort of conceptualizing the way that we think about our own brains, right? Right? So we're sort of defined now by our processing speed that we have and, like, all of these other words that are embedded now in the culture. But before that, you have clock culture.
Yeah.
And our world becomes reoriented, so, and our experiences become reoriented by the way that life is now defined by the clock.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Those are perfect examples of what we're talking about. Again, like, so maybe an older version of human-machine communication or culture and of what technoculture is getting at, right, is these definitions, are these changes in perception of reality of ourselves that you find in the language that we're using to describe those things.
Yeah.
And absolutely, you know, with the invention of, I mean, the telegraph, early communication theory and the discipline was very defined by these these words that were used in technical disciplines and then ported over. Cybernetics, which is the backbone of a lot of this as well.
Oh, absolutely.
And feedback loops. So, right. So the ways that these, when in this linkage human-machine, it's, again, when I'm looking at these things, when other researchers that I'm interested in are looking at these things, part of the question, some of the questions that we're asking are things like, right, how is the human deconstructed biologically, physically, you know, emotionally?
Yeah.
How are those things then, in technical senses, then embedded into machines to make them sense in certain ways, to make them operate in certain ways, to make them move in certain ways?
Right.
What is this predilection with the humanoid robot, for instance? But then how are those things different? How is machine vision different from human vision?
Yeah.
How is machine hearing different? What are the similarities and what are the differences? And again, how do those impact one another? So, like, how is machine vision changing the way that we think about our own vision?
Right? Yeah.
So there's always this coupling. So I really do think about this in cultural terms, that these are relational dynamics. They're co-constructed.
Yeah.
And so that's always the framework that I'm thinking about with human-machine communication. And often with my own work, it's also, how are those relationships expressing some kinds of power relationships?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? In these exclusionary ways or these definitionary ways.
Right, right. So you talked about the first two layers. Did we get to the third one in terms of what human-machine culture means?
No. So the third one, although I would say also these are interrelated, to be quite honest. So the third one, though, is, like, think about it as kind of like culture practiced. So if I was talking, like, I tried to come up with some different ways of thinking about this: culture represented, culture created, and then culture practiced. And so the way I think about this is something like, there was an article that was just published today in the Washington Post that was called "What to Do When You're Accused of AI Cheating," right? And there was all this discourse when ChatGPT and OpenAI, or when OpenAI released ChatGPT last year, about, like, what are we going to do in the educational fields? You know, like, what's this going to mean for writing studies? What's this going to mean for journalism? What's this going to mean for education in general? And these echo the same kinds of discourses that often come around with any kinds of new technologies, for sure.
Absolutely.
Seeing the title of that piece now this year is a really interesting moment of the culture practice, what I would call the culture practice part of this is, which is, how are we responding to this these communicative machines? What different kinds of cultural discourses are being created in response to the development of those devices and are those machines? And then how are we implemented? How do they actually get implemented in practice in everyday life too?
Yeah.
So even though part of my personal kind of perspective is really informed by kind of like the culture industry work or Marxism in those ways and dominant culturality ideologies, which I think is really useful here at this campus, kind of bringing this back to tech and the way that I think of these students, for instance, or the scholars that are in these technical fields as producers of communicative machines, which are the distinction between a communicative machine and another machine is that the communicative machine is itself a media, right? In that it's creating, like, it can tell you a story, right? It can tell you what the truth, it can answer a question if you ask it a question or something like this. Mm-hmm. And so like how are these students and scholars cultural producers now, mm-hmm. even though they may not think of themselves as that?
Right.
How can this kind of research group help them understand themselves as cultural producers and the ethical and social implications of that in deeper ways? I feel like there's always this kind of reflection kind of at a surface level. It's like, I think they care mm-hmm. about what their machines are going to be doing or how their technologies are going to be used, but they don't really necessarily, they don't have a humanities orientation or training to really think about the deep connections or the connotations or associations that these kinds of things get brought up or how they're going to be used and implemented
right.
In practice. And we don't often have a good sense of that without going out into the field and observing what mm-hmm. people do with these things and how they relate to them in their everyday lives. So a lot of it becomes speculative or works in the lab, right? Mm-hmm. But then when it's out in the field, it's something else. So this cultural practice is, yeah, how are people actually relating these things? People who aren't being super reflective about this or asking questions about anthropomorphism, mm-hmm. Don't care at all. And they're not seeing these things as communicative machines. And this really is just kind of an intellectualizing of a relationship. Although there's lots of evidence that suggests that that's not the case.
Right.
But then there's just myriads of practices that you can't anticipate mm-hmm. or uses that you can't anticipate that once those things are on the field, alter and develop end up producing transgressive kinds of cultures, right? Things that challenge the dominant ways of thinking and knowing and being with these machines.
Yeah, I think what you're saying about this cultural practice part, like in terms of the speculative aspect of, okay, so we're in the midst of producing something and it's not yet ready to go out, or it hasn't made an impact that we can really measure in a qualitative or quantitative kind of way. It's still important to do that speculative work, because if you're not thinking about like how this becomes embedded in culture, how we're communicating with these different things, and you just drop something in, right, that can have really catastrophic implications, consequences for the way that then it is taken up and actually used.
Right. And actually OpenAI's release of ChatGPT is a perfect example of
yes.
this, right? But it was a huge cultural mover. I mean, and so lots of things that were speculated about, lots of initial reactions aren't how things are actually playing out. But that's, you know, harms are both worse and more mundane than they're made to be mm-hmm. when those discourses are first articulated. And like, actually, this is, again, where another project I would consider within the purview of this is very specifically when, you know, Congress called up Altman to talk about OpenAI, and you had all these, you know, technologists coming and saying, oh, these, you know, this generative AI could pose a existential threat to humanity.
Sure.
But then the question is, like, why focus on that when there are real harms that are already happening to marginalized groups, have been happening? AI is not new. It's embedded in hiring practices, right? It's embedded in practices of whether you're not accepted to college. It's embedded in practices of credit checking and housing discrimination. Mm-hmm. And so all of those. So by doing this research and having a research group like this, you're really trying to get past that kind of first level of the discourse mm-hmm. and go really deep into understanding why that's the prevalent discourse versus other discourses, again, orienting around these human-machine couplings. And I do want to take it back for just one second, because I really like that you brought up this speculative point of view.
Right.
Because the other thing that I'm also interested in, I'm interested in lots of things, I won't ever be able to do all the research, but also the nice thing about trying to have a research group is maybe you get other people to do some of these mm-hmm. Research projects that you can't do yourself, or to interrogate them, is we also can be looking at history and historicizing with the way that people were thinking about machines as communicative. Mm-hmm. So there's a book that was published a few years ago called Gods and Robots, Myths, Machines, and Ancient Dreams of Technology by Adrian Mayer. And this is a very humanities-centric book in looking at lots of documentation from the Greece and myths and in that area, and trying to think, there's not specific terms that are used that say like robot, but there's lots of ways that things are talked about in that book that look a lot like robots and thinking about robots, for instance.
Okay.
And so you get this idea that people are speculating about these kinds of devices.
Yeah.
You know, in obviously don't look like what we're thinking about in the terms of these devices, but they might be. They might be huge. They're oftentimes gods, humanoid forms in some way and shape, requiring some kind of maintenance. And so there's lots we can go back to. Or there was also a book published a couple of years ago by Adelaide Voskuil. I don't know how to pronounce this. We'll have to double
check.
Hopefully
we got it right.
Yeah. And I haven't read this book, but I just found it when I was kind of, as I've been doing more research in this area, called Androids in the Enlightenment, Mechanics, Artisans, and Culture of the Self, which is really another fascinating kind of project that looks at the ways that automatons, which we often think about now when we're thinking about it today, we often think that those represented like threats of industrialization and alienation.
What
the little blurb that I've read about this book, and the reason I want to read it, is that she's making an argument that these very much were, in the moment, were not expressions of concern, but they were expressions of creativity and aspiration.
That's really interesting.
So, right. And so like those things change over time. And so again, also, why do we respond to these formulations, these couplings, the way that we do? What does that reflect about our larger culture?
Yeah.
And obviously what we're talking about here is very U.S. Centric. You know, there are many other cultures in the world. Like Japan is a good case study of a culture that has a very sophisticated robotics culture or communicative machine culture, and has a very different speculative and imagined relationship to those devices than people in the United States, and therefore have incorporated them into daily life in a way that sometimes we reject here in the States. And so why, like, again, this is these are all cultural issues. These are all questions of culture at their root.
Yeah. You know, what's fascinating too about, as you mentioned, this case study with Japan, you can see this historically with the way that Japanese media mediate this relationship and how to speculate about technology. It's very clear from manga and anime, beginning in the post-war period after World War II, where you have the first anime Astro Boy come on the scene. That is a he's like half human, half machine, and so it's really speculating this relationship and kind of in the shock of all of these new technologies of war and destruction. And I think they really took this towards a more positive spin in a lot of ways. I mean, certainly there were speculations about like war and the doom and gloom, but there's a lot of really positive portrayals of what technology could be and how it could be used and relationships between humans and machines that sort of reflect this idea that you're talking about in terms of them having this really positive and progressive sort of like human machine culture that they do.
Right. Yeah, that's a great example. So there's a ton to be studied. So human machine culture means a lot of things to me, and there's lots of things that we can study in the research group. But again, there are things that kind of orient it, right? There's humans somehow involved. There's communicative machines, and there's culture broadly construed, but largely taking a critical cultural orientation to these kinds of questions and rooting them in understanding relationships of power and how language changes over time and how that changes our perceptions of ourselves and our relationships to these things. And I will say one final point on this, what I consider human machine culture. It's also studying the people who study things like human machine communication. It's asking a meta question, like what is the culture of the scholars who are doing human computer interaction research, who are engineering these devices, who are doing human machine communication research, and how are their cultural biases or definitions or ways of approaching these human machine couplings? How does that shaping the ways that we think about those relationships, what constitutes a machine communicator and what doesn't,
right?
What constitutes a human ultimately? I mean, because really this question is interesting in that at the end of the day, a lot of this is about trying to understand what humans are, who humans are.
And like really interestingly too, like how do you, because these two concepts, right, human and machine, are really loose and fluid, and there's a lot that you can put in both of those things. How do you know how to separate those things? Right. Because instinctually we know it, but how do we articulate the difference between what a human is and what a machine is?
Well, and I actually think that I'm not so sure we do know it very well.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that we have very much come to think of ourselves as machines. We use language a lot mm-hmm. that implicates us as machines. And increasingly, we humanize our machines. And
yes.
So there's really interesting questions to be asked. I mean, that's why we really have to nail down a little further into this to try to understand how that's happening, what's really at stake here. And hopefully that's partially what we're, you know, hoping to get done with the research group and linking into lots of other research that's happening mm-hmm. in the United States and in the world. This is an area that's just exploding right now.
Yeah.
To be critical about it, because there are some questions about why is it exploding? Why is there so much money and emphasis being put in these areas? And what then is being lost by focusing mm-hmm. so much on these areas? Mm-hmm. That's always something we have to keep in the back of our mind. But I also don't think that's a reason not to study the
Absolutely.
Space, right? And if anything, again, we can bring that kind of critical orientation to our own research and trying to understand why this is an important area to study at the moment.
Yeah, all of that is fascinating. My head is spinning. If you're listening, maybe yours is too. But after the break, we're going to come back and talk about haptics and what that means, and then pivot towards some other kinds of questions. All right, and we are back from our break. So Jason, I just want to ask you what haptics is to round out our conversation for today.
Sure. So haptics is a really complicated term, actually, and the way that it's been used across different disciplines and in different areas is often ambivalent and ambiguous. So I think about this term, I identify this term in at least three different ways. The way the term haptics is used, at least in technical fields, first, you know, historically did position it as almost synonymous with touch.
Okay.
But as it developed, as haptics has been used in increasingly in fields, especially that have pulled from psychophysics, so people do haptic engineering, they oftentimes do make some delineation between haptics as just like anything related to touch and technology mm-hmm. and try to narrow it and delimit it by considering it a part of the human touch system, specifically related to kinesthetics and our tactile system. So in other words, the ways that we feel things on our skin and also the ways that our muscles feel things as we move through space. Like haptics then is the muscle movement and the feeling of something on your body or on your skin kind of at the same time.
Okay.
Again, kind of as a psychophysical definition that is taken up then by people in engineering and computer science and other spaces.
Okay.
And that's important to note because that delineation is marked against things like your proprioceptive system, which is your ability to understand where you are in space and related in space to other things.
Oh, okay.
And additionally, there's been an identification of things like nociception, which has to do with the idea that we have specific pain receptors. Mm-hmm. And most recently in this area, the identification of things called C tactile afferents, mm-hmm. which are supposedly nerve fibers that allow us to sense social signals. And this has been a really big, interesting area of development, especially for people that are doing like human robot interaction, for instance, and incorporating haptics into this space because, you know, this is kind of a gold mine for how do you get people to want to have relationships with robots or other kinds of devices and that are beyond just kind of like rational, functional approaches. But how do we make them relational objects? And if you can get them to evoke some kind of emotional response or some kind of social response, this is kind of something that's really exciting from that perspective, from those disciplines and from those areas of research.
Sure. One thing that came to mind, and this comes back from an earlier part of our conversation. So that first term that you mentioned, it starts with a P and I'm not going to be able to pronounce it correctly, but I think it was in terms of thinking about like the way that we understand space in terms of touch.
Proprioception.
Proprioception. So that seems like it would be really important for robots, like the kind of work that you were looking at for surgical robotics and how they understand that space in the surgical work that's being done. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, so doctors and nurses certainly have a well-developed sense of proprioception.
Absolutely.
When you go into an operating room and you have all these apparatuses around you, all these technologies, and now with something like the Da Vinci, this big robot, you have to be very well aware of where you are in space in relation to the patient, also because you're trying to keep things sanitary. So a lot of, actually, when I was doing my research, one thing that I saw a couple times was people who would bump into the robot after it had been draped with like a plastic gown in order to protect the device and also to protect the patient, mm-hmm. to provide some sanitation. People would get very upset because then you would have to redress or regown the Da Vinci, right? So in that space, though, the Da Vinci itself doesn't have any sense of proprioception. It has no sense of touch. There's no tactile sensors on it that would allow it to do that.
Okay. I wasn't sure if the robot also had that going
on. No, it does not. And the closest that it would be is that it does have like visual sensors. So when you go to, position the device over a patient, there are visual sensors that kind of lock in or target areas. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing to do with touch, actually, or sense of proprioception within that device. But it's interesting that you bring that up because a colleague of mine named Mark Patterson recently has just written a couple of papers. He's doing a lot of research into this area of human-robot interaction and trying to think about how intercultural communication, some theories and concepts from interpersonal communication could be adapted into this space. And one of the terms that is very much related to proprioception is this concept of proxemics, mm-hmm. That was developed by a scholar named E.T. Hall back in the 60s, and basically identifying that people in different cultures, they space themselves differently in relation to their relationship to a different person, right?
Yeah.
So if you're intimate with somebody, you might stand very close to them, mm-hmm. and feel comfortable standing close to them. And if you're in a public space around strangers, you tend to stand much further away. And as an example of how effective that kind of relationship is, if you go into an elevator, right, mm-hmm. and you're with strangers, you tend to want to move away from them.
Right.
And if you're with your partner, you're okay being close, right? And so that that's related to proprioception because that's our bodies in space being able to feel ourselves also around others and how close we might be to others. Okay. And Mark talks about this in terms of robots, in terms of if we're going to consider how we want to make robots social, we might want to consider how we can imbue them with a sense of proprioception, right?
Put
some kinds of proprioceptive sensors in them.
So to clarify, that's something that is still being worked out for robots.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, his article is largely speculative in nature in terms of there are some robots that are these things are happening in labs where they are happening. But he's making an argument that researchers that want to make social robots need to be considering these aspects. And they could have a lot to learn from interpersonal communication in terms of what you would want to incorporate in terms of touch. So, 'cause he is a scholar who also has a long background in studying haptics from a different orientation as well. And so just to get back for a minute to this term haptics, and since we brought up communication as a discipline, mm-hmm. communication also uses this term haptics, but it uses the term haptics in the broadest sense. So it very much equates haptics with touch. When you see it in the literature, it says that haptics is the study of communication of touch.
Okay.
So that's the where they make the distinction between touch and haptics, it being the study of. But in that space, then what they're concerned about or what they're interested in is, what does a hug denote and what does a handshake denote? What does a high five denote, right? If you're at the bank or if you're at the library or I don't know, if you're buying something mm-hmm. at a retail shop and somebody strokes your hand, how might that influence the way you're going to receive their verbal message, right?
Right.
There's actually a very limited amount of research that's been on haptics in this formation in communication. And most of it's been done in the space of interpersonal communication, mm-hmm. specifically looking at things like persuasion or romantic development.
Okay.
So it uses the term very broadly.
It's really interesting because it seems like we just have a lot of unspoken rules about what you can and cannot touch.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the case. And again, the research has not been very robust and even helping us understand culturally how we understand what we can and can't touch. Although there is a really interesting research project that's been going on for the last 6 years now. It's a group called In Touch at the University College of London that is doing they're wrapping it up at this point, but they did a large study on digital touch communication. So they were really interested in how these emerging digital devices, especially that incorporate haptics. So the haptics, the first way we kind of defined it for engineers, touch-based interfaces, how that influences people's interactions with one another, but also even how they think about the terms touch and like what kinds of term they did. A lot of their research is looking at like what kinds of terms do we associate with touching these kinds of devices, right?
Okay.
So yeah, and then to get onto a second way that this term is used, and defined, also you see it a lot in marketing and increasingly in spaces like gaming, for instance, right?
Oh, sure.
That incorporate haptics into their devices.
So in the marketing field, it's used as a way to communicate to people that your devices have different properties that like activate your touch senses, like your skin and the muscles in your body. So like going back to the first way that we had talked about this word being used in engineering. So in this marketing capacity, we're thinking about like gaming controllers that have rumble stuff happening in them.
Yeah. And you're probably actually getting even like being more technical about the association. I feel like in some ways, people just want to use the word haptics and just throw it out there as if it's a cool term, right?
Okay.
Like we're gonna say this has haptics instead of touch or rumble or vibrations or something else, right?
Sure.
Because haptics itself is you know, more technologically interesting as a word, right?
Or yeah.
There's some association with that sounds more sounds cooler.
With the sophistication of gaming, it would make sense that they're delving into terms that really like connote a sense of high tech and scientific and engineered, because people are paying a lot more money for video games than they were even 10, 20 years ago.
Exactly. And you said, I mean, this is especially associated with virtual reality.
Yeah. Okay.
That makes sense. You want to be able to immerse your whole body and feel everything that you're seeing and that you're hearing, right?
Okay.
So yeah, absolutely. That's another way then that term has been largely used and become kind of ubiquitous. I mean, probably 10 years ago, if you asked somebody if they'd heard the term haptics, they may not have. And now I would say a large amount of people have heard the term. They may not know what it means really, but they've maybe heard it.
Yeah.
You could probably see this on Ngrams and in Google as well if you search the use of the term. So that's the second way. And then there's this third way that is more in the orientation of how I use the term in my own research and how the people who are interested in haptic media studies, I would say, use the term. And that is more a recognition that haptics is a product of technoscience and that it's always, in some ways, it's always associated with touch machines. So it's not even the idea that we have, like you can delineate a haptic aspect of your touch system has to do with the fact that you've measured it at some point, right? That it's been quantified by science and specifically by technologies of science that have been created to try to say that we have this system that then we can make technologies to induce certain kinds of feelings about touch, right?
Okay.
And so that is a kind of a, I would say for me, it's kind of a it represents a media technologies approach to how we might think about technologies. So how might be thinking about how does the scientizing of human touch define haptic interfaces and how do haptic interfaces define or scientize the body?
Okay.
And I think this is an important distinction, and it's this really distinction that David Parisi makes in his book, Archaeologies of Touch, which came out in 2018. It's an excellent book that really has laid a lot of groundwork produced some foundational concepts and ways of understanding this for people in the field. But so that presents a point at which you start to ask a question of or start to recognize, wait, just like everything else, haptics is also a construction, right? It's a socio-construction. It's not, it's a socio-technical construction because we're constructing the term and what it means and the ways that we're associating with the body, but also there are these technical apparatuses that are systematizing how we think about touch in our bodies and relate to it. And again, then, so what David's doing what he does in his book is lays out separates this into his chapters into these things called interfaces, which roughly align with eras of the development of haptics or haptic devices, and starting with Ernst Weber and even before that a little bit, all the way up until very recently, where he goes into looking at some patent laws and the ways that that constructs touch with a company called Immersion, which was the company for a long time that basically owned all the patent rights to all the vibrations in your phone. And so that becomes a very cultural constructive moment as well. So really kind of getting away from this, like if we go back to this, the first definition we started with of haptics within the engineering field, in some ways it's challenging it's challenging the naturalization of that term within that field, right?
Right.
And showing that there's choices that are embedded in this, just like all of our technologies, and that those choices matter and the ways that we frame them matter. And so that's really been important for me in trying to think about my own research in this area. And so while some of my research I would say is more oriented around haptic media studies, I also want to use that definition of haptics and embed it and bring it into my research with human-machine communication. So in this chapter that I recently published in the Sage Handbook of Human-Machine Communication, one of the arguments, kind of like the takeaway argument that I make in that piece is for a haptics-oriented human-machine communication, thinking about machine communicators as haptic media or the haptic aspects of machine communicators. And that means treating touch as something that can be instrumentalized, essentialized, quantified, and made to fit the protocols of technoscience. Mm-hmm. So making those fit the protocols of these machines, right? And that has limiting aspects to it. It opens up potential spaces. It certainly frames the way that we think about touch and its potentialities. And so like I can tie that back again to this kind of original definition or the original way we're talking about this within the engineering field. When I was saying, you know, the goldmine area now for the field is trying to figure out how do you unlock emotions in people, right?
Okay.
And that can be highly exploitative. And that's one of the things I'm going to be very critical about.
Yeah.
But you can certainly see the desire and why people would want to do that, and for potentially positive reasons, but also for a lot of surveillance capitalist kind of reasons, right?
Absolutely.
And so so constructing touch in this way, thinking about C afferents and defining them, instrumentalizing them, seems to potentially unlock this area, right? Where you could develop this kind of effective and emotionally connective relationships, social relationships with machines. So that's part of the reason I think it's really important that we take this haptics-oriented approach to human-machine communication, that we don't just continue to forward the kinds of ways that we looked at human communication, which is largely through audio and visual texts, and through spoken language and written language. And we have this opportunity with human-machine communication as a sub-discipline, which is kind of opening space for rethinking about what counts as communication and what doesn't count, for us to also reconsider, what counts and doesn't count in terms of our modalities as well. So there's this moment that's happening right now that I think offers this really nice convergence between these two kind of emerging areas that for me is really exciting, certainly orients my research and you know, hopefully would be interesting to others as well.
Yeah, I think thinking about haptics in terms of the history, like where it comes from, I do have a quick clarifying question. So how old is this study in like the engineering, this first sense that we talked about? Do you know?
Oh, that's a really good question. And without, you know, like a reference book, I can't say for sure. I will say that there is a really important piece that was written by Ivan Sutherland, I think in the 1960s, although you might have to find correction on that, but called The Ultimate Display. And that was one of the, I mean, that had to do with setting the terms for virtual reality. But within that two-page document, one of the arguments he makes is that the ultimate display is a display that would be so real that, you know, if you got shot by a bullet, you'd die. And so that he was anticipating this haptic interface. And there was the experimentation of haptic interfaces in the engineering field, at least back to the 60s, I'm sure even before that.
Right.
But those things are slipping my mind right now. I'd have to go back to my books to double check.
Yeah, and I mean that's totally. I was just curious, like from a generalist standpoint, like how old is the field? Because thinking about like the way it's used in those three different ways, so in terms of engineering, but also communication and marketing, but also in terms of like technoscientific culture and like a critical perspective that comes from media studies, having all of those three things together for a burgeoning, very interesting field that has only come about in the past 80, 90 years is really interesting. But I think it also speaks to the importance of studying haptics and the ways in which maybe we've overlooked this in the past, but how critical this is to not only human life, but also to like a technocultural life and a perspective of thinking about our embeddedness with technology and culture.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, the truth is that, you know, if you want to start haptics back from studies of psychophysics, then you're taking it back much further, even to the 1700s, that really start to, at least in, from a European perspective, maybe there's other research that was happening in other places of the world. This is the seam that I know of, where it's emerged. But so one of the arguments that haptic media studies is trying to make, or was what we were trying to do in 2017 when we published a special issue on this in New Media and Society, was to call attention to this very thing, to say, and this is what David's work is also, that book is up primarily about as well in some ways, is saying, hey, there has been this whole area of research going on in this area of haptics. That's really important. And they have been thinking about it at its potential to be communicative, right? And thinking about it in terms of communication. So why, as a communication field, the media studies field, why have we not been studying this? And so part of this is trying to make an intervention in a space that actually does have a much longer history.
Okay.
Because there is a kind of intervention that we can bring to this space that is seeing it from a critical cultural orientation and questioning its assumptions, right, in a way that it isn't able to do. And that's really important for somebody like David, because one of the things that keeps happening in this space, one of the things you see if you do look at the history of engineering development of haptic interfaces is that they're kind of cyclical. They keep kind of making the same things over and over again, and kind of forgetting their own history, or not recognizing that there is a history.
Yeah.
And making kind of the same claims to things like, oh, a haptic interface will allow us to be immersed, really immersed in a space. But that confuses what immersion really is. And there's like lots of research now that suggests that, you know, you can read a book and be entirely immersed, right, in that book, and not just immersed like, oh, I love reading, but, you know, your brain, you do an MRI of your brain, it shows that you are, you know, lighting up areas that are related to smell and touch. And
it's very much this concept of transportation, like being transported into the text.
Right. That's a really good way of putting it. And and so actually what's interesting about haptic interfaces is that often they don't allow you to transport into those spaces because they're often bulky, because they confuse people with their signals, because they have one more, what they're emoting, like they're using one more sense to create another channel, and that can be confusing for people who are used to being immersed visually or auditorily. And so, and that might change over time, right? So like this is something that we might adapt to, and that we may come to integrate into the ways that we experience media. But there again is an intervention that is being made from media studies and from communication, which is to say, you can't just make a device and people are just going to accept it like as if it's some naturalized thing. It's biologically relevant. This is cultural. We learn these things. We learn how to, I was thinking about this earlier, and I forgot to say it, that I don't know if you know who John Berger is.
Sounds so familiar.
So John Berger had this really interesting series on the BBC in the 1970s called Ways of Seeing.
Okay.
And it had a lot to do with the ways, making an argument that technologies of seeing, you know, the camera, that these things fundamentally changed our relationships to things like time and space and our ways of seeing the world.
Yeah, no, when you were bringing that up earlier, that we privilege visual, so we're very much a visual culture. We were not before the camera, for example, like that. Like, I think the privileged sense that we had was either smell or hearing. I don't know which one it was, but yeah, prior to those kinds of technologies, we didn't think about the visual as strongly or rely on it as much as we now do, which is fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that much. I mean, I know in the anthropological studies, there's actually a pretty wide range of how people have dominant senses or dominant ways of of perceiving the world through different senses historically and even now.
Yeah.
But I guess the thing that I want to link to with that ways of seeing is that this, you know, as an analogy, this is about ways of touching, right?
Right.
And that, again, ways of touching and ways of understanding touch and ways of relating to what touch means, those are constructive. They're, at least to some degree, they're constructive.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is about what we're trying to get at with this definition of haptics and, you know, applying a media studies, communication studies, cultural studies lenses to the space.
I think it's really amazing that the work that you're doing is helping to historicize as the history is currently happening and potentially changing the future. Seems like a really great generative space to be in.
We'll see.
I just want to ask before we end our podcast today, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners before we close out?
I just guess I want to say that if you're interested in anything that we've talked about today, you know, please come talk to me. If you're interested in being involved with the research group, I'd love to have your ideas and your input. Doesn't matter whether you're doing highly technical projects or more social science or humanities oriented projects. Mm-hmm. I would love to have you be involved because all of those areas involve culture.
Yes.
In one way or another. And we all have a lot to learn from one another.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I do have a small cadre of embodied robots in my office, and I'm looking for some people to work with me to code some of them so that we can have them interacting with people around campus.
Oh, wow.
Maybe for artistic purposes, maybe some production at the Rosé, or maybe it's in somebody's classroom somewhere. So
wow. Yeah. That sounds awesome.
Thanks, Kendall. I really appreciate it.
Jason's social media links will be posted in this episode's description. To all of our listeners, thank you for joining us for another thought-provoking conversation on all things IPEC, the Institute for Policy, Ethics, and Culture here at Michigan Technological University. If you'd like to continue this conversation, our email is also linked in this episode's description. The mission of the Institute for Policy, Ethics, and Culture is to promote research, policy engagement, and teaching that address the ethical and cultural challenges, implications, and strategies unique to the emerging technocultural environment. Michigan Technological University is a flagship public research university founded in 1885. We overlook the Keweenaw Waterway and join in community with the stewards of this land since time immemorial, the Ojibwa peoples. In our co-presence, we carry forward a commitment to listening, to allyship, and to joint stewardship.